It's September 26, 2016, and you're listening to Monday Morning Meetings on Migration, a conversation about migration and politics at the University of Amsterdam. I'm Darshan Vigneshwaran. Now, on the 16th of September, European heads of state met in Bratislava to discuss the fallout of the Brexit debacle, and importantly for our listeners, to chart a path forward for the EU's migration policy. One of the signal achievements of that meeting was the Bratislava Declaration, which, amongst other things, stated that Europe was, and I quote, never to allow the uncontrolled flows of last year and to further bring down the number of irregular migrants, end quote. The declaration also included a commitment to broaden member state commitments to doing their share and helping one another address the refugee crisis, and to expand Europe's efforts to work with non-members to address migration flows. This is strong language from a seemingly hobbled institution. Now, on this podcast, we've been talking a lot to migration experts, and today we've decided to move away from that trend. And what we wanted to do was, instead of asking for what migration scholars to think about a declaration like this, to go to someone who's an expert on council politics. And with that in mind, we've got Sandrino Smits, who's a lecturer at Radboud University in Nijmegen, and also at Aarhus University in Denmark. Sandrino is an expert on council politics. He attends council meetings, he observes the actors engaging with one another up close, and he sees how declarations like these are made. So, hi, Sandrino.
Good morning.
Now, there's a lot of strong language, I want to start off with that, in this declaration about what the European Union and its member states plan to do on, in particular, immigration control and refugee policy. What does a declaration like this actually amount to in European Council politics, and what can we expect to see?
Well, indeed, the language is quite strong, but it's, of course, the result of almost a year of debate on this particular issue. And so this is mostly reconfirming a couple of things they agreed to, especially end of 2015. But I'm not the first one to quote Jacques Delors on this, saying that, okay, European Council conclusions almost have the status of treaty articles. So give me some conclusions and I can do something with it. I can come up with legislative proposals or anything. But if I have no conclusions to refer back to, then that makes me, that makes a commission, that makes the EU institutions very weak to act. And that's something we saw very clearly also in this crisis, I would say. In the beginning, Commission tried to get leadership without a mandate from the European Council. Then Germany tried to get leadership, Merkel tried to take over without European Council conclusions, without having the backing of this institution. And now you see in the conclusions that, okay, we have a common common line of arguing about this issue, I would say. And we agree on a number of things, rather general, but still, okay, this is something quite substantial, I would say.
And do you see that as likely to be a lasting consensus? Because it appeared in the run-up to the meeting that, well, the states were heading in very different directions on this issue.
Well, there are a couple of elements to this. So the first, the uncontrolled flows of last year and that part. I think there's a more or less consensus on that issue right now that, okay, basically, this is what President Tusk has been arguing for last half year. Merkel was the main opposition, and that takes some that took some time to convince her of the need to add this. So, and also the second part about full control over external borders and getting back to Schengen, that's a clear victory, I would say, for Tusk and others, saying, okay, we cannot discard Schengen without having something else. And I think everybody has come to terms with that. Of course, the controversial part is the final statement. We have seen many declarations of responsibility and solidarity, also in the euro crisis, for instance, and that never really amounted to much, with the exception of Greece. But with other countries, solidarity mechanisms and stuff like that are always very vague. And okay, burden sharing is another key term, catchphrase that everybody uses in these settings. Well, that seems rather uncontroversial on paper, but in fleshing out the details, there might be a lot of opposition.
Yeah, I mean, let's build on that a little bit further. You were talking about the parallels between the migration crisis and the financial crisis, and specifically the role of the council in trying to achieve an agreement there. Do you see any similarities or differences between an agreement relating to the movement of people and an agreement about, you know, who's going to fund the Greek bailout?
Not specifically the Greek bailout, because that was really crisis management and that was really an intergovernmental affair, I would say. So classic member states in charge. But the overall dealing of the process, you see the same, you really see the same dynamics. So we have this new institutional setting with the European Council presidency, who doesn't have a big staff or a lot of resources to actually manage this process, but who is vital for ensuring coordination between the intergovernmental and supranational pillar. So we see, we saw it perfectly in the refugee crisis, also in the EMU crisis. Member states will not accept Commission leadership. So Juncker really had to tone down his rhetoric and his ambitions on this regard. On the other hand, member states also do not accept German dictates anymore. So both these allies are close to a certain degree. And then you get this system of constant coordination between member states at European Council level, which then leads to incremental progress towards a common language on this particular issue. And that language is vague, and but yeah, Brussels is often built on constructive ambiguity, as they call it. The language is sufficiently ambiguous to cover a lot of different positions, but still, it's on paper now, so it's also agreed to a certain extent that this will be our line to follow. And so that's also what you saw on the EMU deepening process, the reform of the Economic and Monetary Union, where based on European Council guidance, they were able to build the banking union, for instance, which was a very maybe the biggest step in European integration since Maastricht. And it came out of a couple of declarations at the European Council saying, okay, we need to address this vicious circle between banks and sovereigns. Now, here you see something similar. If this border guard really gets up and running, then that might be, then it's a very significant step, I would say. So we are looking at a situation in the EU where member states and institutions are really looking for new patterns of leadership. I think that's the core of it. Who is now in charge? And what we see is this collaboration of collaborative leadership, I would call it, collaboration of institutional actors and core member states, which finally come to terms with the fact that they really need each other if they want to make it work, I would say.
Well, this seems to be a really key issue in, I guess, migration policy throughout the Union, is that the emergence of relatively recent member states, Eastern and Southern European states, playing a much bigger role in the formation of migration policy. Is this a lasting trend within the Council, and do you see it continuing into the future?
Yes, that's something that that I also found very interesting. I had expected this to happen earlier, to be honest. I had expected that with the final phase of the euro crisis in June 2015, that a lot of these smaller member states were kind of fed up with Franco-German dictates or dominating the meetings and coming up with their own proposals. But then, okay, that was a final instance in which the old Europe, the old way of doing business in Europe, which was always built on a Franco-German axis, worked. But here I think they underestimated how sensitive on a domestic level this issue is, especially the relocation schemes, which they negotiated, they talked about, Commission proposal for mandatory relocation. That's very sensitive, especially in Eastern European countries, and I think they underestimated it. And these member states, the Visegrad countries, have really established a form of cooperation and noticed that their weight counts in these negotiations. So I think that's here to stay.
This is all fascinating stuff, Sandrina. One of the other things that you mentioned that I'd like to hear more about is that this sort of declaration doesn't come out of thin air, right? It doesn't actually happen in Bratislava. It's been building for about a year, yeah. Right? Could you give us an insight as to what may have been taking place over the past year, how you get a deal like this done?
Well, we had it especially, of course, in February, March, when the deal with Turkey and stuff was being negotiated at the time. So you have a couple of channels which are actively cooperating. You have the supranational channel, commission channel, which has its regular comes up with proposals. They are discussed in Coreper, so the permanent representatives, and then in the General Affairs Council, and then it goes to European Council. That's the normal community way of doing business. But and that was how they always did it. So before European Council, you had the General Affairs Council, and before that, Coreper had already discussed the conclusions, which were created mostly by the Commission, I would say. So that's the old normal way of doing business. But now you have this separate channel, this intergovernmental channel, which is new, which pivots around these Sherpa, the Sherpa level. The Sherpas are, it's from the Nepal, from what you know from Nepal, the people helping helping you up the mountain, I would say. These are the personal advisors of the heads of state and government, and they've also become kind of a permanent informal meeting, forum, for negotiating these conclusions. So either a commission comes up with proposals, or you have a European Council member like Merkel, for instance, saying, I would approaching Tusk and saying, I would like to have a summit, have a declaration on this and that. It's always the European Council presidency who has to launch the process. But yeah, you can imagine if big member states come up with such suggestions or invitations, it's difficult to say no. So it leads to a very long informal process played on two levels about what these declarations will state and what will be in them and what will be out of them, or what will not be in the declarations, sorry. And here these first centers had these uncontrolled flows. They hassled for weeks at different levels about whether the word chaos should be included. Well, we should never return to the chaos of 2015. That's something that Merkel really wanted out. So these words are very, very sensitive, but by the time it gets to the European Council, most of it will, of course, be decided already by these channels I mentioned. So,
well, I guess that makes perfect sense, given that if what you're saying is correct, that these sorts of declarations almost have the authority of law, the wording really matters.
That's the essence of European Council decision making, but also European Council decision making is in these words, and these words are never cheap. And a lot of these sessions, even at European Council level, come down to drafting exercises, I would say. So going through the text para by para, asking whether member states have objections to this particular phrasing or that particular sentence, whether they want to change the ordering. That's basically what I did when I was working in Brussels. On a very low level, the working group level, but there we did the same thing, just hassling over text and what should be in there and how much emphasis should be put on something else and so forth. And then at the final level, you get to a text. But the core message here is that at this point, it becomes agreed language. And you can always refer back to agreed language as I said, more or less the status of law, saying, but we agreed to this in the past, so now you cannot say, okay, sorry, I changed my mind on this. That's something that cannot be done, or is not done.
I know a lot of my colleagues who would love to have had that sort of access to this sort of declaration, to be able to really see how this sort of language is produced. How do you think, in the end of the day, that now that the language is there, bureaucrats in Brussels will be responding? What will they be looking to when they're thinking about the formulation of migration policy for the Union? What sort of status will this declaration take?
Yeah, with the Bratislava declaration, I find it a bit difficult to these are not formal European Council conclusions. It is a declaration that everybody agreed to, more or less. It's now up to the institutions, the Commission in particular, to take this a little bit further. And European Council presidency will, of course, make sure or will keep the overview, I would say. So it again depends on how much ambition is the Commission willing to show, also based on what member states are willing to accept. And especially, I think the first two, as I said, are relatively uncontroversial. It's quite basically a question of how much resources do we want to make available to actually make this system work. The final part about long-term migration policy, and we all agree that the Dublin system is not perfect, and there needs to be a re-evaluation of that. nobody wants real treaty change or negotiating about de facto treaty change, especially not before the election. So, yeah, the Commission has to really square the circle here a little bit by making something that sounds ambitious enough to actually satisfy Germany in particular and a couple of others, while not forcing something upon the other member states. And I think that could work, because Europe is all about applying gentle pressure, and when there is opposition, then you wait a while, and then you apply gentle pressure again, and at some point a member state or the obstructing member state will say, okay, I'll go ahead, I'll move a little bit into your direction, and then we can move forward.
Well, speaking specifically on that issue about obstructing member states, so one of the things that's going to be in many of our listeners' minds when they think about this declaration was the lead-up. And there was a spat between Luxembourg, who was accusing Hungary of not doing its fair share on asylum seekers, and hypothesizing that they should be potentially kicked out of the EU. I mean, these are big sorts of words, and Hungary responded, of course, in kind. What do we make about that sort of posturing in the lead-up to events like this?
Window dressing, I would say, to be quite honest. Yeah, this certainly will not happen. It happened a year ago when the crisis was really at the height, and tens of thousands of people were walking through the Balkans, and then it was a little bit more. But now, I would not, especially since it was a Luxembourg. Objecting to Hungary, not a key player. Hungary is, but Luxembourg is not anymore, since it's no longer the presidency. So now I would not. I think that's the same thing with Renzi's declaration afterwards. For domestic reasons, he had to show opposition, and I think he informed Hollande and Merkel beforehand. So I'm going to object to what you're going to say. I'm not going to take part in your press conference because I need to do that. And there is agreement. That for domestic purposes they need to take a strong stance, and I don't think it will affect any of the dynamics at European Council level as such. But that's my conjecture, I would say.
Look, that's been a great bunch of conjectures, Sandrina. I think you've had provided us with the sort of insight that honestly people who do the day-to-day study of migration politics just couldn't come to the table with. So thanks a lot for appearing on the show.
Glad to do it.
For those of you who are interested in finding out more about Sandrina's research, you can find links to his staff page and a sample of his work at our blog, 4mpodcast.com. Monday Morning Meetings on Migration is run by the Institute for Migration and Ethnic Studies at the University of Amsterdam. You can access us through iTunes or Stitcher, and subscribe for updates on Twitter and Facebook. In the next couple of weeks, we'll be posting direct to the Beyond Trafficking and Slavery subsite of Open Democracy. As always, if you have suggestions about a story you'd like us to feature or would want to post an audio rejoinder to something that's been said on a previous podcast, please send us an email at imes@uva.nl.